From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells. Our first guest this morning is Dr. Dahlia Kirschbaum. She's the chief of the Hydrological Science Laboratory at NASA's Goddard Space Flight. Kirschbaum has a number of responsibilities in the study of landslides, including developing new techniques for rainfall-triggered landslide hazard assessment and forecasting. She's also the deputy project scientist for applications for the GPM mission. Again, GPM stands for Global Precipitation Measurement, and it's a constellation of satellites that together make sophisticated measurements of rain and snow of the entire world every 3 hours, including the GPM Core Observatory that can CT scan a hurricane. Dahlia Kirschbaum, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. It is always a pleasure to speak with you.
Di, it's always a pleasure to have you on. It's always one of the most interesting conversations. We love what you do. Lynn and I have always said, we want your job. But you know, maybe we can start with this, and we always start with the same question. For our listeners that aren't familiar with the GPM mission, can you just give us a brief overview?
Absolutely. Well, the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission, or GPM, has been co-led by NASA and the Japanese. And it launched in 2014 with the goal of providing global estimates of precipitation, rain and snow around the world. And it actually has the most advanced instrument on board its core observatory to take those measurements of everything from light rain to heavy rain and snow, which is obviously very important where you are. And so it also is able to work with a constellation of other satellites, both from domestic and international partners, to provide a global view of rain and snow about a 10-kilometer resolution every 3 hours around the world. That's important for everything from storm forecasting to agriculture, disease tracking, and even what I do with disasters, which is landslides.
Yeah, exactly. I'm curious about this. I had my eye on Hurricane Irene as it moved up the Atlantic coast in late August, and I had my eye on it because I'm interested in hurricanes, but also because I had a trip planned to Boston the day that the tropical storm landed there. It was a tropical storm, it was a hurricane, then it was back on as a tropical storm. And I wanted to ask you this question. They, at some point, it hadn't hit land yet, and they were sending planes in there, I think, to ascertain wind speed and things like that. With GPM, you have a sophisticated microwave that can look through clouds and look at varying types of rain patterns in the storms, and you also are able to CT scan the hurricane. Is there anything that we have technologically so that we won't have to send planes in all the time? Can you technically get the wind speed without the plane?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the airborne flights, the planes that fly over hurricanes, are not just taking surveys from the air. They actually are dropping things called drop zones into the storm to measure those wind speeds directly. And so that's a really powerful tool to be able to ascertain kind of the dynamics, the behavior of the storm, how it may intensify. But from satellite platforms, you know, for example, with GPM, we are able to take three-dimensional pictures of the rain and the snow in these storms. And so we can actually see snow on the top of hurricanes, the first time we've been able to do that from space. Especially when they're in the oceans and we don't have as many ground-based measurements. But in addition to GPM looking at rainfall, we have other satellite missions that are enabling us to look at wind speeds and other characteristics that impact the storm. And those include sea surface temperature and height, for example. So looking at how warm the water is to provide energy for storms, and even kind of where it may impact a bigger storm surge. We have satellites called Cygnus, which is a constellation of small satellites that actually look at wind speeds using information from GPS signals that bounce off the waves to detect the movement of the waves and wind. And then once a storm makes landfall, we have information on soil moisture, and that can actually serve as an additional heat source for storms, and also indicates areas where there may be flooding, or other hazards associated with extreme rainfall.
When we talk about climate change and the changing Earth, you said you're focusing right now on landslides. How does that how does your work in that help a little area like us? We just had a big fire have caused some evacuations, and now there's a nice burn scar around these homes. How does this technology help us prevent more loss of life or destruction of homes?
Sure. Well, I'll take a step back first to talk a bit about a climate change. And so when we're speaking about the impacts of climate change, we're really talking about heat, right? And so heat can impact the wildfires, as you suggested, making them more pervasive or more intense. They can also change the intensity or the frequency of extreme storms. And so when you put all of those pieces together, when you look at, and then you combine that with measurements of the surface. So Landsat, the Landsat 9 satellite just launched on Monday to continue the longest running Earth observation information series in the world, dating back to the 1970s. And we are able with that information to get a sense of where the burned areas are and really where landslides may be or are. And so it's not just, so I guess the point is that we have multiple pieces of this puzzle. And with modeling capabilities, such as what we've been developing at NASA and with partners, we can bring together the extreme rainfall information with the presence observed from space of burned areas and the topography. Is it steep? Is it not? And even get a sense of what the soil moisture might be with some of these events to really identify these hazards. And then ultimately, what creates a hazard into a disaster is who and what is affected. And so with other technologies, you know, for example, we can look at the night lights. We can look at the power coming from different communities. During a hurricane, this tells us where, you know, power outages may have occurred. And so this is an example, Hurricane Ida. We saw this pervasively across New Orleans with Ida, is power outages as a result of the storm passing over. And we can also use other socioeconomic data to combine with these models to really get at the impacts you're talking about. So I hope you take away from this is that it isn't just one technology. It's how we combine all of these Earth system information and technologies together to get at this information that can be, you know, used for mitigation, used for awareness and warning for these types of disasters.
Yeah, looking at a lot of these models and videos on the site, which we will have in the show notes for today's episode on our website, but there is a lot of computer data that is coming together. And like you mentioned, there's so many different technologies. I know these are kind of buzzwords now, but how is like machine learning and AI helping us better understand these storms and natural disasters to help us hopefully maybe prevent worse damage in the future or just have a better understanding of what's going on?
Kind of all of the above, actually. So, you know, machine learning and artificial intelligence applications are pervasive. You know, with all of our Earth system satellites at NASA, we have over 24 satellites. More are set to launch in the coming years. And we have volumes of big data. And that requires, you know, big strategies to harness the power of that information to really make projections on what's happening or look in the past. And so I'll give you just a couple examples. One is on looking at the land surface. And so if we think about how landslides, you know, may be impacting an area, well, we have a model that actually uses landslides, and with machine learning, it actually trains the model based on all of these different components to get a sense of what is the likelihood of a landslide in this location, training it with known landslide information, which we have. Another example is with weather forecasting. You know, we're able to put this types of information, working directly with operational agencies, into information that brings in the data. We call it data assimilation into models. So soil moisture, observations, temperature, precipitation. And then with machine learning and other capabilities, we're actually able to provide a better state of our system in order to project out of what are the days to decades to come in terms of the potential environmental states and change. And so AI and machine learning are just really powerful tools, especially as our data and our open data continue to grow dramatically each year.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Dr. Dalia Kirschbaum, and she is the Chief of Hydrological Science Laboratory at NASA. She also has responsibilities as Deputy Project Scientist for Applications for the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission. And Dalia, these applications are fascinating. I'll just take a step back for a moment. A lot of people are not, you know, don't know how much NASA does to study our own planet, with study the atmosphere, the land masses, the water, everything. And also a lot of people think that we have these satellites up, that we're using all this data for ourselves, but we have provided all sorts of support around the world. And one of the applications that I found fascinating was the GPM Indus River application that you have, trying to help out Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, and those countries. Maybe you can take a minute and talk about that application.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that's important to note is all of NASA data is open to the public. And one of our goals is to make that data usable for decision-making and to support activities around the world. And so the application on providing information about water resource and fresh water availability in the Indus is a great example of that. You know, one of the leads of that work is advancing how we connect data from the subsurface through what we call the GRACE satellite. It actually looks at gravity changes to ascertain where we have volumes of water in underground aquifers and how those are changing. And it combines that with satellite precipitation from GPM and soil moisture data. And so what some of the scientists have done is taken that information and put it down to the level of the individual farmers, where they are able to say and get a sense of when they should irrigate their crops or when we should plant. And so this type of situational awareness, we call it, is vital for really their livelihoods and for making informed decisions about when they choose to provide enhancements to their crops. And there are so many examples of that. We have scientists that are using precipitation data to look at disease tracking, to look at areas where there may be outbreaks of malaria based on the conditions that are ripe for those types of mosquitoes, like looking at temperature and vegetation changes and precipitation. And then we have, you know, all the way to microinsurance, you know, being able to use this long record of precipitation that we have to actually develop payout strategies to small subsistence farmers or business owners, and based on the amount of rain they're experiencing, they could actually get automatic payouts so that they can continue their livelihood without as much disruption. So it's pretty exciting to see the breadth of applications that these types of data products are enabling.
It certainly is exciting, and the proof of the pudding is, are the farmers using this data? And looking at the Indus River, in 2016, 700 farmers were using this data on their cell phones. Today, there's over 100,000 farmers that are using this information.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think that's the point here. You know, the goal is to really discover and enable, you know, discovery of this information so that they can make good decisions about their local environment. But I think the key here is that we have all this data, we have tremendous science capability, but if we can't figure out how to connect to those users, then it really doesn't work. And so I think that's another component of this, which we call capacity building, working with the people maybe who are developing the applications to provide those to farmers. We work quite a bit with those we call them boundary organizations, you know, being able to talk to both communities. And then, you know, some scientists working directly with organizations that, have consortium of farmers, for example. And so by being able to continue to build capacity in different areas of the world, we hope that there will be more and more uptake of this information for public good.
And when you talk about index insurance, I read up on the application that you have about this dry corridor, which is Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and Nicaragua. that are historically dry anyway, and then with climate change, they're even drier. And so what you're saying is, rather than the government taking a guess at who needs to be compensated with money because they weren't able to put their crops in the ground or they weren't able to grow crops, this is a way of being able to go specifically into geographic areas and say, these farmers need help, these farmers are okay. Is that what happens?
That's exactly right. So actually the group that is working on this specifically is a small micro-insurance company that, you know, they don't have access to gauges, and the gauges are, you know, unreliable or sparse in this area. And so by being able to have continuous observations of precipitation, you know, they're able to detect anomalies or differences from normal that may trigger extreme precipitation and trigger floods, or on the opposite, trigger droughts. And so this kind of dry corridor is so sensitive to those changes. And as an insurance provider, they were able to monitor that in a way that they wouldn't be able to if they had to have, you know, boots on the ground to monitor the fields and to monitor kind of what the situation is in the environment there. So it's a really powerful tool that they've been able to use, especially in more remote areas.
You mentioned that this is at least the main satellite is a joint project between NASA and Japan Space Agency. And you mentioned that there's a lot of different satellites. How much satellites and are we talking about? There's thousands, if not tens of thousands, of satellites in orbit right now. How many satellites are we talking that combine to help create this data?
So at present, we have about 10 satellites, which have what we call microwave information for the most part, which is similar to what we have on the GPM Core Observatory. And so that enables us to paint a global picture of highly accurate precipitation estimates. But where we have gaps in coverage, since the microwave sensors are in what we call a low Earth orbit, so they orbit the Earth, providing swaths of data every time they go around, complementing that are geostationary satellites, and those sit out, you know, at 20,000 miles away, and those provide different types of information in the infrared to enable us to kind of combine this information. But what I will say is, you know, I'm in the process of helping to plan NASA's next missions that focus on not only precipitation, but also aerosols, clouds, convection, and kind of all of the interactions of what causes precipitation and extreme convection and storms. And so while we take advantage of those 10 satellites now, there are a large number of commercial satellites that are interested in this space, as well as future missions from our partners, such as the European Space Agency, the French, the Indians, Japanese, as well as the more broad community at NASA, to really address these challenging issues of how precipitation may change around the world in changing climate.
And you mentioned that this data is for all over the world. We're looking at the entire planet as much as we can. And we just talked about how that data has some real-world applications. Is there one particular study that your team has done that just stood out to you as really fascinating?
You know, I think that one that is memorable to me is the fact that satellites really fill an important void in data. And what I mean by that is there's a study that came out in the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society. I was a co-author on that. I was far down in the author list. But it basically did an analysis that if you take all of the rain gauges in the world and put them together, they'll only fit into two basketball courts. And so you can imagine how important it is for global models of weather and climate, and then, of course, local applications, to know where the rain is in your own community, but also where it's coming from. And so that's why satellite data on precipitation and other states, of course, of the environment are so critical, is that, you know, we don't have ground-based measurements in many locations, including in some places in the United States. We have excellent radar networks, but even that doesn't have full coverage over our states. And it doesn't extend pretty far off the coast. And so I think that is one of the striking realisms is that the vantage point of space is so powerful and needed to really get at the global system and how things are connecting.
And in September 8th, 1900, a very large hurricane hit Galveston, and it was a total surprise. And we didn't have satellites back then. 6,000 to 12,000 people are estimated to have been killed, lots of damage. What would satellites have done for us if we had them back then?
Well, you know, Galveston is a really interesting example. And so I've read a little bit on this. And, you know, one of the things that that was a challenge, in addition to not knowing how extreme the storm was and really understanding the dynamics of hurricanes at that time, it was also a lack of communication between several different organizations. So some people actually knew that the storm was coming, but it was a failure to connect the dots to some extent, of course. And so what I see, you know, if we had this type of infrastructure back then, well, let's be honest. I mean, last year in 2020, we had $22 billion disasters in the United States alone from fires, from droughts, from hurricanes, and from extreme rainfall. You know, we had over $95 billion in damages and 30 named storms. And so we're seeing a Galveston-type storm. We've already seen it in the U.S. In fact, you know, we have we've already had 7 hurricanes, 4 Category 3 storms that have made landfall that have existed, and 158 fatalities and $55 billion of damage just this hurricane season, and we are not done yet. So we see Galveston every year now, and that is why these types of technologies and data are so critical. But you also need the communication systems and why we work so closely with our operational partners to really advance those to make the appropriate warning to the appropriate communities so that they can take action and be safe.
Dr. Dalia Kirschbaum is the Chief of Hydrological Science Laboratory at NASA at Goddard Space Flight. She also has a number of responsibilities in the study of landslides, including developing new techniques for rainfall-triggered landslide hazard assessment and forecasting, and, of course, the applications we were just talking about for GPM. We've only scratched the surface this morning, Dalia. We're going to post with the podcast the 4 videos that you had sent us a while back, and if there's anything else that you'd like us to post with the podcast, just send them along to me.
Sounds great. Thank you so much.
Well, we very much enjoyed having you on the program. We wish you continued success. And just a very, very quick question. We only have about 30 seconds, but 6 months is the season right now for hurricanes. Is it possibly going to be a longer season in the future?
You know, I really can't speak to that since no one makes the operational forecast. But what I can say is that, you know, we're seeing more extreme storms now. Climate change is impacting our storms now. And so I think that it is so important to develop sophisticated models that allow us to understand how hurricanes intensify so we can make the appropriate warnings when they do happen.
Dr. Kirschbaum, you're the best. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.